Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, January 9th, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Mike McKean, Futures Lab Director at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. We're back from our holiday break and ready to tackle the new year's media-fueled controversies. Here with me in the RJI studio are Views regulars Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis, both faculty colleagues from the Missouri School of Journalism. We're going to change the focus just a bit for our first show of 2013. None of the usual politics, no fiscal cliff or debt ceiling news, no bickering over Al Gore's sale of Current TV to Al Jazeera, no talk about photoshopping missing congresswomen into a publicity photo. Maybe we'll get to some of that next week. Instead, we're going to consider, how does science journalism stand up to the blizzard of weight loss and healthy eating stories we see this time of year? What about that new study that says those of us defined as overweight might be less likely to die than normal weight people? Are there institutional imperatives that cause journalists to focus on or misinterpret scientific findings that so often turn out in the long run to be wrong? Meanwhile, science news got a big boost in 2012 from social media. Are we in for more of the same in 2013? Nothing stirs the pot during the slow news holidays like a writer accusing first-person journalists of being narcissists. Is he right? We'll consider the role of personal reflections in today's news coverage. And the New York Times releases a mesmerizing multimedia story just before Christmas called Snowfall. Some say it points the way to a bright future for online news. Others aren't so sure. Well, Americans are, statistically speaking, about the fattest group of people on Earth, and we're getting fatter all the time. Ironically, we're also addicted to stories about getting and staying healthy, especially at this time of year when we look to science to help us keep our New Year's weight loss resolutions or justify letting them slide. A study released last week in the Journal of the American Medical Association, or more precisely, stories about that study, give hope for both sides. Researchers analyzed data from nearly 3 million people in more than a dozen countries. The upshot is that body mass index, or BMI, that number we often use to determine whether we're normal weight, overweight, or obese, doesn't predict mortality very well. In fact, the study shows people categorized as overweight are less likely to die than people labeled normal weight. Well, Lee, you're very interested and have been following science journalism for a long time. This study offers, I think, some important insights into how we report health news and other science news.
It does, in part because it hangs so much on a single number without providing the context. So if you go back, oh, just a couple hundred years, being overweight or obese was a sign of literally having enough calories to eat. The fact that you have enough calories to eat has a lot to do with how long you live. And that trend is certainly just as true today in different parts of the world as it was a long time ago. So it's one of those stories that if you look at things through a single lens and you ignore history and social class and war and all those other sorts of things, you're going to get a result that is actually going to come me and make my doctor furious.
But even if you look at the numbers in today's context, I mean, the way we interpret scientific information, whether it's about weight loss or other health stories or anything else, there's some real questions about how journalists approach it. And I guess, Charles, the first thing to say is that clearly there's a demand for these kinds of stories. And I wonder if journalists are just giving into what people want, or are there ways of approaching these stories that would be better?
You mean they're looking for outcomes that will make readers happy? there might be an element of that. I am always struck by the fact that of all the different disciplines out there that journalists must cover on a regular basis, none is more ill-suited to journalism than science, I don't think. And that's because science is slow. It's tedious. It's incremental. It has nothing to do with the complexity. I mean, journalism tackles all sorts of complex subjects that are very difficult to understand, and they do a good job. It's the process of science that really confounds journalism, I think, because the two are just they're almost opposites in a way.
Well, and in fact, I would recommend for our audience some reading, and this is what drew me to the topic today in the first place. It's the cover story in the January and February edition of the Columbia Journalism Review, which you can also get online. We've got a link to it on our blog, and it's called Survival of the Wrongest, How Personal Fitness Journalism Ignores the Fundamental Pitfalls Baked into All Scientific Research and Serves Up a Daily Diet of Unreliable Information. Well, Lee, one of the primary points that the writer is trying to make in this story is that consumer and lifestyle health news and sort of the simplistic way we approach that kind of science is crowding out more important or more sophisticated health policy stories. Do you buy that?
I buy that, but it's done this, at least that I'm aware of, for the past 20 to 30 years. Every readership study that I've seen of, you know, topics that Americans want to read about in their newspaper or magazines, health is right at the top along with sports. You know, you put those two things together and you capture a huge market. You look at TV and you've got, you know, daily shows like Dr. Oz. I mean, there's all kinds of places where viewers and listeners and readers go to get that sort of information. The problem with all of it is, I'll go back to something we talk about a lot. It's the journalistic story. So I do a story that today chocolate is bad for you. And then 2 weeks later, there's another study that comes out that says today chocolate is good for you, but Brussels sprouts are bad for you. And I never journalistically, through journalistic routines, am prompted to put those three studies together and then to talk about them critically.
Well, I wonder if that's just because, you know, we, first of all, are not very sophisticated about following the science, even science journalists, all the way down the path. We tend to rely a lot, Charles, on news releases, or at the very least, we tend to rely on the words of scientists who have a lot more credibility maybe than politicians or business people, or at least we think so.
Well, and I thought the Columbia Journalism Review piece hinted at it. It never came right out and said, but I think it strongly hinted at this. And this is a real issue. And that is that because a lot of the daily journalism around personal fitness, I think, is the term that the writer used. And that's a good term because so much of it has to do with the sort of you journalism. How do you lose weight? How do you get healthy? And what that obscures, I think he makes this point rather eloquently, what that obscures is these macro level science and health policy stories that are way more important. What he doesn't say in the article that I think must be addressed by probably mass communication researchers at some point is that when the editorial is so bound up in the advertising, it's very hard to trick out personal fitness from selling you personal fitness stuff.
Well, he was also saying, Lee, I thought that just the process of science produces contradictory findings. I mean, the problem he points out, one of them, is that we tend to highlight or focus on those studies that generate the most sensational claims or the most counterintuitive results. And maybe it's just not the journalists and the editors either, but the people who publish the science journals. And maybe even scientists are looking more toward those kind of impact stories.
Well, it's certain that science is about, all about impact, at least scholarly impact. But there are a couple of other deeper things going on here. I think many scientists feel like they don't want to talk to journalists because they think, for a variety of reasons, most of them empirically demonstrably wrong or at least badly out of whack. And there's not an ethic in science, which I actually think there should be, that if you're taking money from the public trough, i.e. you've got NIH funding, you've got NSF funding, you've got EPA funding, you have an obligation to talk to the taxpayers because they're the ones who are paying the freight, whether you want to or not. I've said that in a couple of places in rooms full of scientists and have been met with, in one case, literally gasps, that I would say that there needs to be a connection between the people who pay for what you do and your willingness to talk to us.
Well, let's play that out a little bit further, Charles. There was an interesting article that I've got on the blog from a discussion that happened in Great Britain this past summer where they had some scientists and journalists talking about what their role should be. And some people say the role of journalists should be explainers. We showcase new discoveries. And others say, oh, no, we should be exposers, that we uncover wrongdoing or we look into the conflicts of interest. And I just wonder if are those goals mutually exclusive?
Not at all. And I think there's probably a third. We should be the conversationalists that continue the conversation about the science that leads to the discussion. I mean, part of this whole fat discussion, I wish I could come up with a more artful term for it, but this conversation about fat and the scientific literature involved is perfect in a way because it is that contradictory nature of science where you have evidence being brought forth on a daily basis. Some of it makes sense with our personal narratives. Some of it is at odds with our personal narratives, I think. Some of it makes us feel more comfortable. Some of it makes us feel like we have a lot of work to do. And all of it, I think, needs to be thrown into that big conversational hopper called journalism, which also at the same time should be providing accountability, but also doing a great deal of explaining. Science is just extraordinarily difficult, and it doesn't lend itself to the episodic, here's today's story sort of treatment that we give it.
Well, reported or not, Lee, it seems to me that stories involving science got a pretty big boost this past year, especially from social media. There's a piece in the New York Times about that that points out that some of the most tweeted and YouTubed moments of 2012 actually included things like James Cameron going down to the bottom of the Marianas Trench, the landing of the Mars Curiosity rover, Felix Baumgartner jumping out of that 24-mile-high balloon. Now, those also had sort of an adventure story focus to them, not just straight science. Seems to me, though, that there were some pretty clever people, whether it was Red Bull or NASA, who were making these things seem more adventurous and yet still giving us a bird's eye view into something that others might not have paid attention to.
The one thing those events, those stories also have in common is they're around an event. Science is hardly ever an event. It's somebody in a lab or somebody crunching numbers about social science research. It's the, oh, so help me, the disproving of the null hypothesis, which is just a backwards way to go at anything, but it is exactly the way that science moves itself forward. So you have those events, which are fun. They're also highly visual. And at the same time, there's a whole bunch of science over here that's not getting that kind of coverage because it simply doesn't have that to bring to bear.
Fair enough. I mean, it does seem to me, Charles, anything that gets people to focus on something having to do with science and discovery is probably a good thing. On the other hand, we have to point out that I think with all of those stories that I mentioned and a lot more, most people, including most young people, found out about them and continued to follow them directly from the source through social media, not through mainstream news organizations.
True. But if it does engender that sort of passion for discovery, it's probably the best way to describe it, whether that comes from social media or traditional media, eventually it leads to probably greater research and sort of a thinking of scientific career, hopefully, among young people. And it's one of the things we've struggled with as a nation is getting people reinterested in science. And so I'm hoping it's just a virtuous cycle that people first become exposed to it because somebody tweets something and they go, man, that's cool. And then it begins to sort of make them turn their head a little bit.
There were non-event stories that were probably more important from the world of science this past year, Lee. I can think of, you know, discovering the Higgs boson, the so-called God particle, and what that might mean for how we understand, you know, life as we know it. There was the data that just was released this past week showing that officially 2012 was the hottest year on record in the United States. We had a study that showed we can learn things while we're sleeping. Heck, who knows what that can mean for education in the future. I'm wondering what you think might be equally important or interesting this year that journalists should be looking out for in the world of science.
Okay, so you're going to walk me out on this ledge, Mike, and I'm going to jump off of it. And we're using the word science very broadly, to include science, medicine, health, and the environment. So I'm going to start with the place that I'm more comfortable, which is the environment. I think one of the big stories for 2013 is going to be literally what's the impact of what I believe is going to be a continuing drought. We've already had a pretty bad drought in the last year on a whole raft of things, some of which include things like the Mississippi and Missouri rivers, others of which will include crop prices. So all of that sort of stuff. I think the drought is also a story that's really part of what I believe is the largest scientific-based story that we've got, which is understanding global climate change and what that is all going to mean in a political and an economic and a social sense.
Charles, what do you think might be one of the bigger stories to anticipate in the area of science writ large this year?
I have to sort of dovetail Lee a bit. I mean, I was going to say environmental politics. This is, I think, the year in which a lot of hand-wringing about climate change becomes solution-oriented approaches to climate change, because we've now reached an inflection point where even we're getting all the way down to the last naysayers, really. If you're paying any attention to the bottom of the world right now, Australia is on fire, literally. Mm-hmm. They are having temperatures that they have literally never seen on the continent. Those sorts of events are going to continue unabated. All climatologists that I've been reading say that they expect 2013 to be at least as volatile. And if it is that volatile, I think it's going to start having very real effects on the body politic. And that's going to be fascinating to watch.
I agree with that, of course. I think one of the other big stories to watch for this year is, I think finally we're going to see emerging into the public sphere where people can really understand it, what we've been calling for a few years now, big data. I think we're going to really see how it is that the way the world is wired and wirelessly delivering information about us, about the way we travel, about the way we live our lives, the health care we get. All of this is going to come together in some pretty amazing ways in this next year. And I hope that journalists will do a good job of interpreting that for folks. Maybe we'll spend a show talking about that. Well, speaking of humanizing science, Lee, I think probably somebody who garnered more attention than just about anybody else this year, and maybe some vindication too, was statistician and New York Times blogger Nate Silver. He called the presidential election very accurately, as we know. He's just published a well-received book. And just yesterday, he showed up on the social media site Reddit to a huge crowd of people who are asking him a bunch of questions. In response to one of those questions, he suggested, maybe not surprising to us, that many news organizations downplayed his and others' analysis that President Obama was going to quite likely win the Electoral College votes pretty easy because, quote, journalists were rooting for a close race. What do you think of that?
I think that's partly it. I think there's some deeper things. We would like to think that living in a democracy, that some things are essentially at their core unpredictable. And I think who gets elected is one of those things, because I think that a lot of journalists think that if you're out there and predicting and you're out there and you're right time after time after time, and Nate is just on the very beginning of the time after time after time, you know, a portion of this, that it doesn't just take the fun out of it. It takes part of the democratic process out of it. If by looking at where I live and what age I am and how much money I earn and my past voting behavior, it no longer becomes necessary for me to go to the polls and cast a ballot, that's a pretty good dig at democratic functioning.
So do we just stop talking about polls because they're accurate, but they're telling us things that we don't want to know?
Doggone, they're accurate. I was watching along with that Nate Silver event yesterday online and was struck by a couple of things he said. First of all, he had unbelievably unkind things to say about the punditry, not surprisingly, including the fact, I think he called them psychopaths at one point, which is pretty strong language for Nate Silver, who's not really a bomb-throwing kind of guy, but I think he was sort of wounded by his treatment pre-election. Rooting for was probably the wrong term for what at least mainstream journalism was doing. I exclude Fox because it was clearly rooting. But the people that were doing journalism, I don't think they were rooting for a close election. I think they were hedging their bets. And that's what we do best, which is we will never – I don't care how many polls say it's going to be an Electoral College landslide – they're not going to report that as fact because it's not fact yet. It's a poll.
Lee, I didn't follow it live as Charles did, but I did go through and look at the transcript. And one of the things that Silver said that I found encouraging was that he was going to expand his 538 blog. I mean, it was mostly about the presidential campaign this past year for obvious reasons. But he says, akin to some things you've been talking about, he's going to apply statistics and science to a lot of other fields besides politics. That could make for some interesting reading.
Well, it already has. I mean, think about Moneyball. Yeah. I mean, there are lots of places where this kind of analysis is insightful. That doesn't mean it's the whole story, and it certainly doesn't in many ways take out that essential human element of it. And, you know, sport is a great example. But, you know, you've got things like, you know, Moneyball and sports statistics that are a whole new way of looking at this stuff. And you can say, well, that's great. It makes an interesting read. You can say that's horrible. It turns people into commodities. Both those things are true.
Well, let's switch to a bit of journalistic navel-gazing now for our last couple of topics this week. First, writer Hamilton Nolan stirred the hornet's nest when he wrote on Gawker.com that too much of what passes for journalism these days is, in fact, what he calls narcissism. He was speaking specifically about first-person writing, and there's one journalism teacher that he held up for scorn, Charles. Her big assignment for the semester to her college students is to have them write about, quote, their most embarrassing secret so they can learn to, quote, publish essays and sell memoirs. As Nolan points out, there certainly is a huge appetite for personal essays. Blends in really nicely with social media and reality TV. But, I mean, is that what we should be teaching in journalism classes? How to write first-person narratives?
In part. I mean, it's an art form. It's a journalistic art form, and it has a place at the journalistic table, which he acknowledged, actually, in his piece, which was very – it was fair. I mean, it was curmudgeonly, but it was fair. I do agree with his overall contention that there's too much of it. Bad first-person narrative is bad. People who are truly talented, who are gifted first-person narrative writers – I'm thinking of our very own Mary Kay Blakely, for example. People who can do that and be introspective and be entertaining and are not just in love with themselves are quite rare, frankly. And that point that he made is well taken.
Right. But he was also saying it's out of whack, Lee, and that we really need to focus more on looking outward rather than inward, telling other people's interesting stories and not our own stories.
I think it came at an interesting time. Janet Saidi, who's news director at KBIA, and I team teach a class in which we do several units, which we call point of view journalism. And one of the things that we ask the students to read is an incredibly old magazine piece called I Was a Playboy Bunny. It's the piece that made Gloria Steinem famous. It appears on the surface to be first-person point-of-view journalism. And one of the things we ask the students every time is, how much interviewing do you think went on to write that piece? And the students universally tell us, oh no, she just wrote about her own experiences. Well, then Janet and I get to do what educators do best, which is to say, not exactly. You know, this is how she says she came to that story. Point being, I think especially to young people, point of view journalism looks easy because all I have to do is write about myself. The really talented people, the Gloria Steinems, the Mary Kay Blakelys, the In Another Era, Samuel Johnson, those people were deeply knowledgeable. They talked to lots of other folks, and then they had this voice that makes it sound as if it's first-person point of view, but really it's a whole lot more depth than that.
But even if we don't talk about some of that great, you know, in-depth first-person journalism, I think if you'd ask a lot of our students today in journalism school about first-person and all that, they'd say, you know, the criticism from people like Nolan, Charles, is just sort of anachronistic. It's all those old ethics and principles that don't hold water anymore, and adding our point of view and inserting ourselves into stories makes them more relevant and makes them better.
Yeah, and my response would be, you know, you're 22. You don't really have much of an interesting story to tell yet. So go tell other people's stories first.
Well, if you want to see what I would think all of us would agree is great 21st century journalism, what can be accomplished if you have enough time, talent, and money anyway, is something called Snowfall, which appeared just before Christmas in the New York Times. On their website, on their mobile apps, it came out just a couple of days before Christmas, and the too bad for us, the day after our last show in December. Well, we're going to bring it up today because I think it's important enough and interesting enough. What the story does is it chronicles how and why three professional skiers died in an avalanche last February, almost a year ago, back in Washington State. It features fabulous writing, breathtaking stills, animations, information graphics, slideshows, audio, everything. And it incorporates them all into a really seamless package, it seems to me. It's one of the things that people are pointing out about it. If we have a link to it on our website. If you haven't seen it, go take a look. And we're going to show you a clip from the helmet cam of one of the surviving skiers, Ron Pankey, as he and Tim Carlson reach the bottom of Cowboy Mountain and get their first glimpse that something terrible has happened.
that a ski pole?
Where?
Right there.
Yeah, that's a ski pole. What's that?
Yeah, that moment that I saw a pole sticking up was like the telltale sign of, like, our friends are in there.
And that's just one of many moments in that story. I guess I'll just start out, Lee. What did you particularly like about Snowfall, and what do you think it says, if anything, about, you know, best practices today?
What it says about best practices today is if you can get access to a lot of stuff, and there was amazing access here, that you can craft something. There are some elements that you need. Those visuals wouldn't be nearly as beautiful if they were of the Ninth Street dumpsters. So, I mean, there's something to be said for having the Cascades as your backdrop, even though in this case it's a backdrop to some very untimely deaths. I think it's also about having really talented people that know how to meld visual with verbal imagery and to do it in a way that it flows. I also think that this was an event that occurred a year ago. You're not going to do this kind of journalism now I'll use a terrible example of the Newtown shootings.
Right.
You're certainly not going to do that as they're happening. And that there are a lot of reasons for that.
Charles, what did you like about it? And again, same question as I asked Lee, what do you think it says about best practices?
Well, the presentation itself is just extraordinary, and words utterly fail me in trying to convey how beautiful it is as a piece of multimedia journalism. Also, it was journalism about a tragic event, and in that it was rooted in that place and that time. But it also got much bigger than that when it started talking about avalanche and the science behind avalanches and this specific piece of geography and why it was particularly dangerous. That, to me, was more fascinating, actually, than the personal narratives of the skiers themselves, who, right. I mean, those were fascinating as well, but I got completely enthralled with the science here, to go back to our bigger theme.
But you know, Lee, I mean, as you were sort of hinting, it took nearly 20 highly trained journalists and technicians 6 months to put this thing together, and a lot of critics are saying, that's great, but it really isn't the reality of most news organizations today with the resources that we have available. This just isn't the future. How are we going to monetize something like this and be able to create this if we're not the New York Times?
I don't know that we are going to be able to monetize all instances of it, and I'm not sure that that's what it's about. I mean, one of the things you can like the New York Times or not like the New York Times, one of the things it has a habit of consistently doing is moving the bar. And so I think this piece moves the bar. And I promise you that there will be some 22-year-old journalism student here next semester who will look at that piece and go, I'm going to try something like it. And that may not happen right away, and it probably won't be as good. But this is something that practice actually will have a good impact on. So, you know, no, it's not for all journalism.
Obviously, though, I mean, I agree, it's going to set a good example. Some young person may do something good with it, but we've got to figure out the processes that will allow this kind of journalism to be done more cost-effectively, more routinely, apply it to stories other than something that happened, you know, 11 months ago. And I hope we'll get there. And I guess that's part of our responsibility, right? Well, that's that for our first program of the new year. We appreciate your continued listening and viewing. If you'd like to send us a question, comment, or suggestion, or if you want to find out more about today's topics, visit our blog under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org, or you can email us at views@kbia.org. The guys who make sure we get on air and online each week are Director Travis McMillan with the Reynolds Journalism Institute and Audio Engineer Pat Akers with KBIA. I'm Mike McKean. We hope you'll join Charles, Lee, and me again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.